We've been talking a little bit about a guy named Lot, right? And now we are crossing that threshold about talking about a lot about this guy named Lot. And we're getting down towards the part that most people just jump right into in discussion about this man named Lot, and that is the destruction of the place where he ended up kind of living for a little while before that place got burnt up. And before we actually get to that main text of what many people will go to immediately, I want to kind of remind us about what we've seen so far, because I've taken my time with Lot in this class about people that are lesser known than other characters of the Bible, because I think at least I don't give him enough credit for the things that he did that was right. Lot is a guy we don't know a whole lot about. We know a whole lot about Abraham, about his son Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph, and all those folks, but Lot is one of those people that we don't really know that well, because we don't see many decisions that he made besides just circumstantial things that took place to Abraham and also took place to him. So reminding us that they were both in the Ur of Chaldees, their original location. You had Abram's brother pass away in the land in which he dwelt, which was called Haran, which also was his brother's name. So it was the land of Haran, place where he was living. They went down there as a family unit, and then after that, we find him leaving Haran and going to the place where God would show him with Sarah, or Sarai, his wife, with all their man and maid servants, with all their possessions, and the nephew Lot, and all his stuff, we would assume. They got to a place in Canaan's land, and then there was an opportunity for them to go and get refuge in the land of Egypt. They went down there, and then they were on their way back, and they had been blessed by God, both Abram and Lot. And then they got so large in their property and their possessions and their livestock, they had to part ways. Abram saw that there was infighting going on between the people that were over charge of both their sides of livestock. Abram says, "We're brothers, let's not fight about this. Let's go different directions. You pick the right, I'll go left. You pick left, I'll go right." And that's when Lot chose the well-watered Garden of Eden-esque location that was towards Sodom and Gomorrah, which of course are infamous to us now at that time, and they wouldn't have been that infamous, I would assume. And then we have Abram going to the plains, to the west. And so we find that there was a situation in which Lot was kind of caught up in a political situation, a military force situation. They were taken captive. All their stuff was taken. The king of Sodom and Gomorrah, they were there as well. Abram went to the rescue with his 310 folks, I believe, saved the day, brought all the stuff back. Abram gave a tithe to Melchizedek, which is important for the book of Hebrews. He returned Lot back to his place with all his stuff. He refused any kind of negotiation with the king of Sodom because he didn't even want any association with him. He wanted to trust in God, it would appear. And then we find the situation where we're right in the middle of, in Genesis chapter 18, in which we have three, we'll say, individuals. One is identified as the Lord, and then two of them we assume are angelic messengers thus far. They come towards Abram's camp, and Abram stops them and says, "Hey, let me give you some food, some water, and wash your feet. Hang out for a while. It's the middle of the day. It's too hot to be moving around." Sarah makes food for them. They sit there, consume the food, it seems, and then they're about to talk about the promise that was originally given to Abram and to Sarah, that she was going to bear a child. And she laughed within herself. And the Lord said, "What was that?" Right? And then said, "Oh, I didn't laugh." "Yeah, you laughed," is what the Lord said. And then we look on to verse 16, right? So after the incident in which Sarah laughed and her name was changed from Sarai, we sometimes say, because of the spelling, to Sarah, because she laughed. The men set out from there, so Genesis 18, 16, and they looked down towards Sodom. And Abram went with them to set them on their way. So he was showing them out, right? This was not a city, obviously. It was a location in which he was going to walk a while with them. And the Lord said, again, this is an emphasis on the fact that the Lord being there is emphasized again for us. Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? This is a question, right? The Lord never asks questions for information, right? We kind of say that over and over again, but I always say that to remind us that when we have a question that's asked, more than likely it's rhetorical if God's actually asking it to someone. So he's saying, am I going to tell him what's going to go on here? We know he's got the promise he's going to bless all nations in the future. Should he be aware of the activity that's about to take place? Is he in the need to know, is the real question. Does he need to know what's going to go on? In verse 19, this is probably the most information that I can tell in one verse at least, in which we find how the Lord thinks about Abraham. Because so far, we've not seen a whole lot about how God thinks of Abraham. David was called the friend of God. Samuel was someone that was very close to God. Elisha was. And so when we think about Abraham, we don't have a lot of verses that really reveal to us why this guy was chosen out of everybody else in the world to be blessed. But if we look in verse 19, for I have chosen him, that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. If we look in a different translation, for example, the New King James, I believe it says a different kind of rendition of that. Verse 19, for I have known him in order that he may command his children, his household after him, that they may keep the way of the Lord to do righteous and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. So the small nuanced difference here is in the beginning. I have chosen him, ESV, for I have known him, and in New King James, I think King James is about the same thing as that in the New King James as well. And so no matter how you look at it, we see that God says, this is the chosen guy. I know him well enough to know that he is going to perpetuate the law of God, doing good things, righteousness and justice, that they can continue to be blessed. And that's one little short passage that reveals to us what God knew about this man, Abraham. He was good enough to know that he was going to keep this process of being faithful going. And of course, that was necessary. If you're going to be the father of many nations, you're going to bless the future kingdom of Israel and all nations through your seed line, it's important that you're a good patriarch, that you pass on that law to the next generation. Okay, questions, comments? Okay, verse 20. And the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me, and if not, I will know it. So let's pause there. This is an interesting little statement. It's interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, who was the one speaking in verse 20? The Lord, right? So that would imply he's more than likely the second person of the Godhead before he's known as Jesus. This is who we're talking about here. We've never really seen the Father himself come down upon the earth in such a way. We don't really see the Holy Spirit operating in the physical realm in such a way until Acts 2 and following. And so it would make the most logical sense that the Lord here, Adonai, the Yahweh, or Jehovah that we see in verse 20, is talking about that second person of the Godhead, Christ. And so he's someone that, being deity, is all-knowing, right? That's one of those characteristics that we can infer from all the passages about God himself. He knows all things from beginning to end, because there is no beginning or end for him, right? And so for him to say something along the lines of, I need to go down there and see whether or not it's actually true, is kind of a statement that bothers a lot of people. Why would an all-knowing, all-powerful, all-present God need to actually go anywhere? Well, I think the answer might be something along the lines of, he didn't have to, but he was going to. Because this situation with Abraham, a later situation with Lot, and the destruction that would happen to these two cities would not happen in the way they did And they would have not involved the faith and believing and trusting in God that Abraham and Lot had, had this situation not taken place the way it did. We also see in a few other situations in which God says, I've heard the cry, I went down, I saw how it was, and now there's a certain kind of action that I'm going to take. Right? Hilda? Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of those confusing things with me. Whenever I hear, this is tricky territory, so I'm going to be careful with my choice of words. Whenever I hear a Church of Christ preacher, let me put it that way, that's the safest thing I can say, talk about how other religions, other denominations feel about predestination and an eternal inheritance and free will, it seems very cut and dry and obviously incorrect according to Scripture. But whenever I hear someone who actually holds a position that's different than ours, and they try to make it clear what they believe and why, it seems more fair than we would give them credit for. Because there are some questions that we have about predestination, free will, free choice, and all those things. And so, obviously, I think, Abraham here had a choice that he could make. The Lord knew what that choice was going to be, ultimately. It didn't negate the fact that he made a choice. It's one illustration of this, I think, is pertinent to me now. Maddie is at a stage now where she's going to the crib at night. The rock and play sleeping situation is no longer viable. She's too long, and she likes to jump and hop for some reason, Heather. And she can't stop jumping and hopping even when she's in the rock and play. So she's slamming her booty down on the rock and play, almost flopping out of it. So we had to get rid of that. So now we're on to the full-size crib. So she's rolling around. And she's going, and she's moving, she's skinning up her knees, getting some of her first rug burn on those knees, and she's scooting around like an inchworm inside that little crib. I know, looking at this crib with my information that I have, which is more than what she knows in her present age and maturity level, she can't really go anywhere because she's inside that crib. Any choice that she makes within that crib is going to be severely limited. She can go on her stomach, she can go on her side, she can go with her butt up in the air, she can go on her back, she can roll over, she can flop around like a fish, she can do whatever she wants, but there's a confine that she's in. And she's not able to process that confine yet, right? Imagine that reversed. God is able to see the entirety of the confine of space and time. Wrap your mind around that for a second if you can. So any choice that we make on this little ball of dirt that he made for us in which we can live and exist and make decisions and so on, they're somewhat limited. And yet from our perspective, any choice we make is ours to make. And that's true, but from his perspective, it's a little bit different. And it's hard to process that. And so, yeah, the Lord came down to do what he said he was going to do in 20 and 21, and Abraham had choices that he was going to make. Lot had choices that he was going to make. There's obviously free will, but in the larger discussion of free will and predestination, there's a bit more that we don't yet understand. I'm not sure passing from physical realm to a spiritual realm is even going to answer that question for us fully, because we're not going to be outside of what we've already known. Anyway, that's a whole different discussion. Okay, questions, comments? That was a rabbit I want to chase down for a bit. Eric? Dude, I don't even bring up Jacob around me.
Some things that God does for his information is for our information. Right. When he goes down, that's so we will know beyond a doubt he knows what's going on.
Right. Right. That's the second point that I was going to get to, was the fact that we've seen this kind of thing happen before. There was an occasion in which Moses was just minding his own business for 40 years as a shepherd. And then all of a sudden, God appeared to him. The Lord appeared to him from speaking from a burning bush that was not consumed and said, look, I heard the cry of your people. I went down there. I saw how bad it was. It's time for you to go save them, right? So the way that he said that was so specific, in which he said, I heard their cry. And obviously he knew about their situation before he heard their cry. So praying to him about their situation had an effect, although he already knew about it, which is a good thought for later. Why pray if God already knows my needs? And then he kind of went down there in a way to see what was going on, and now it's time to save them. Megan. Hey, Adam, where are you? Not here. Either that or it was the first ever recorded game of hide and seek. One of those two things. Eric? Well, that's a whole different discussion, I think. Yeah. The question? I don't think he's asking a question there. I think he was quoting scripture. That's my personal opinion. I've heard different thoughts on that. I think he was just referring to the sentiment, the heart, the emotion that was revealed in that Psalm of David, that he felt like he was all alone and no one was with him because he was all alone and no one was with him. I think he was just quoting the beginning of that Psalm as a reference. This is how I feel right now. More so than saying, my Father God, who I'm in holy communion with, has forsaken me because I'm taking upon the sin of the entire world, although I'm sinless. How's that work? I have no idea. So that's two different opinions. I really don't know enough about either one to give you a for sure, because I don't know anyone that does. But my personal thought is he's just quoting scripture there. So I'm not sure it's a question. I think it's just a quote. But that's a whole different discussion. You don't have to agree with that. Okay. Anything else? Thank you for the discussion. All right. Oh, absolutely.
If he wasn't merciful to him, I mean, he wouldn't let him go. And I think we should be thankful that he's merciful to us.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's look at 22. Then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord. Again, one more passage in which we find the sentiment expressed in which these two other guys that they were with went down to what they were about to do, but the Lord was still there with Abraham. Interesting. And Abraham came near. Before we even get there, do you recall the exchange in the book of John in which we have a long discourse about how Abraham was not the end-all be-all for the Pharisees? The Pharisees were there and Christ was there and saying, look, you know, you shouldn't boast in the fact that you came from the seed line of Abraham. It's not that big of a deal. Like, all Gentiles are going to be saved as well through the same gospel plan of salvation. So don't worry about Abraham so much. And they were like, Abraham? The guy we look up to the most besides Moses? Are you serious? He's the one that we always look to. And how did he end that discourse? Before Abraham was, I am. That is a whole other layer on that. If this is in fact Jesus before he's known as Jesus, sitting around the middle of the day having lunch and talking with Abraham. Now he's walking on the earth as a 32-year-old Jew, carpenter's son. People don't recognize exactly who he is. God in the flesh, God with us, Emmanuel, his prophesied name. And he goes, you guys think you know about Abraham, huh? Well, I had lunch with him not too long ago. Talked about the destruction that's going to happen at Sodom and Gomorrah. You're no descendant of Abraham. You're after your father, the devil. And they go, what? Kill him. Blasphemy. It's like, ah. Anyway, okay, verse 23. And Abram came near and said, would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Why do you think he was thinking about the righteous living in Sodom? Well, he knew his nephew was in there. He's like, look, okay, so your guys are going down there, right? So just out of curiosity, if there happen to be righteous people down there, not that I'm saying that there is, But if there happened to be righteous people in that city, would you also destroy them? Do I need to go do a second rescue mission before your angels get there and take care of everybody? Suppose, let's just say, that there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it? It's a good question. Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? So Abraham knew a little bit about who he was speaking to. The judge of all the earth. Their limited early civilization information was not as limited and early as we sometimes want to believe. They're not cavemen walking around just not able to read and write and speak and use logic and speak to God himself in a personal way, right? The Lord said, okay, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes. Did the Lord know what Abraham's going to do next? Yeah, right? But he still let him do it. And I love this. So Abram said, indeed now, I, who am but dust and ashes, have taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. Very respectful, right? He's obviously humbling himself before the presence of God himself. Suppose, just saying, all right, so 50, we agree about that. Suppose there were maybe 5 less than the 50, 45. Would you destroy all the city for the lack of 5? So you say 50 is a good number. What about 45? Are 5 souls not worth it? Good question. So he said, if I find there 45, I'll not destroy it. You ever seen the show Pawn Stars? Right? It's a pawn shop, reality TV show. There's no more reality in that show than any other show you're going to watch. It's all scripted. It's all made up, in my opinion. Sorry to burst the bubble if you thought it was real. But these people come in there looking to sell stuff that's worthless most of the time. They got something they found in a junkyard, and they want to sell it to him for $1,000. And he goes, what? I got to bring a guy in and figure out what this thing is, and then it's worth $5,000. Okay, it's worth $5,000. I'll take $5,000 for you. He goes, no, you know, this is a business. I got to sell it. If I buy it from you for $5,000, I sell it for $5,000. What's the point of me having a business? I'll give you $2,000 for it. I goes, what? How do we meet somewhere in the middle, right? Those negotiation tactics that were ingrained in me shopping at yard sales and flea markets my whole childhood. I look at this and I say, you know what? This guy would have been a great businessman. He goes, all right, so 50, good number. What about 45? Only 5 less. 45? You would kill 45 good people over an entire city that was righteous or wicked. Said, okay. I will not do it for the sake of 40. We're skipping down to verse 30 now. Then he said, let not the Lord be angry. Don't get mad. We're still negotiating here. I will speak. Suppose 30 should be found there. He said, I will not do it if I find 30 there. He said, okay, indeed now. I've taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 be found there. I will not destroy it for the sake of 20. Abram, listen. Listen. I'm the Lord. I got this. But just saying, verse 32, don't be angry. And I will speak, but one more negotiation. What about 10? Why do you think he whittled it down to 10? I mean, you got Lot. Apparently Lot's married to at least one lady. He's got some daughters we're going to figure out a little bit about later on. They probably have some husbands and so on. So 10. Safe number. All right, so you're not going to take care of the entire city, figure of speech, for 10 people. All right, good luck, Lot. I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. So the Lord went his way as soon as he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. I wonder what in the world Abraham told Sarah about that conversation. So what did he want? Oh, they're going out of Sodom. Oh, where Lot is? Yeah. Yeah, they're going to destroy everything. What? But don't worry. I negotiated with God. I talked them down from 50 to 10. It's a great deal. Great bargain. Anyway, for chapter 19 is where we get to the troubling and somewhat fascinating stuff. troubling because obviously this is a city that's completely depraved, completely evil, wicked in God's judgment. Even in this ancient time, God's like, we have to take this entire city off the map. We don't even know where it is now except for the sulfur, aka brimstone deposits that are found there. Now, the two angels, the two messengers is a literal way to say that, right? The two angels came to Sodom in the evening. Seems like that would be a bad move if you were a traveler. And Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. Let's pause there. The gate. The gate is a very interesting ancient location. The gate of the city. We don't really live in gated cities anymore. We have gated communities. It's a little bit nicer, I suppose. But a walled and fortified city to impede attacking forces, the gate was very important. If you had business that you had to do when it came to someone in authority, you did it at the gate. Because if you think about the times, if you've got a guy who's hostile against you, you don't want him to go inside the inner part of this walled, fortified city to talk to the king in case he has more folks behind him, in case he tries to assassinate someone, in case you have to put him to death really quick, in case you want to kick him out and make him an exile. If you do it at the front door, you don't have to worry about him being already within the house, right? When someone knocks on your door and they want to talk to you about something, you don't know who they are. Do you just say, hey, come on in, let's go to the bedroom? No, of course not. It doesn't make any sense. Same thing in a logical way happened here in ancient cities. Everything important took place at the city gate, the front gate. Also, that was where someone who's in an authority figure would sit to judge people under the law of Moses. So if they had to be exiled, had to be stoned, had to be released from the city to go on to a city of refuge, for example, the city gate was where that took place. And Proverbs, talking about the virtuous woman, and the virtuous woman's husband is known well at the gates. The idea of the important, prominent political people know about him because of how good his wife is kind of the implication from that. So, last time we saw Sodom, he separated from Abraham. He went towards Sodom and Gomorrah. He pitched his tent even as far as Sodom, was the last thing we heard. He got swept up in that captivity, got taken captive. Abraham brought him back to the rescue. And now we see him sitting at the gate. This would imply, more than likely, that he was someone that had some kind of political, social power in this city now. So he went from someone who just kind of camped out to someone who was taken captive, someone who was brought back with a bunch of wealth. The king, no doubt, when he saw, hey, you're associated with that guy Abraham who helped us out, you're now important here. That could have been what happened. It's one thought. Okay, questions, comments about that? Okay. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them. He bowed himself with his face towards the ground. You think it would be a common behavior for Lot to bow before everybody that approached the city gates? I don't think so. He said, "Hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house and spend the night. Wash your feet, and then you may rise early and go on your way." So what did he do? He was very hospitable, right? He nailed that pineapple right over his front door. And he said, "Look, all, welcome to the city. Here's some advice. Come home with me. I'll wash your feet. I'll give you food. I'll give you water. Stay the night. And then the next day you can go on your way." Seems so friendly, right? Now, verse 3. And they said, or 2 part B. And they said, "No, we will spend the night in the open square. So we'll just stay out in the middle of nowhere, in the wide open at nighttime in the city of Sodom." Great idea. Verse 3. But he insisted strongly. I wonder why. So they turned into him and entered his house. So they were like, "No, we'll just camp out here in the middle and see everything's going on. Don't worry about it. We're here on official business, you know. We got it." And they go, "No, you need to come home with me right now. Don't worry about it. Just get in my house." And they go, "Okay." And then he made a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. And here is some really confusing stuff, y'all. Verse 4. Now, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter, surrounded the house just to say hello, I'm sure, to say welcome to our nice city, glad y'all are here. Verse 5, and they called to Lot and said, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. And the New King James implies the word here carnally, in a physical way, sexual way is the implication. Let's just pause. I'm not going to go too far down this road. I'm just going to simply say, I've heard a lot of people over my lifetime talk about how depraved our society is. When I grew up, I didn't grow up in the church. I grew up learning everything I needed to know from Nickelodeon and Disney Channel. I grew up learning from media, from my friends, from my school, things that I didn't even know I was being taught, but I just accepted. I was basically taught that it's okay for someone to be homosexual. It's normal. It's fine. We're all wired differently. You want what you want, and that's just basically it. And then I've heard people, after I was converted in the church, say how bad our society is. Folks, it's not apples to apples. Sure, we've lost some important battles in our culture over my lifetime. But verse 5, if this means what it says, this is an entirely different level of civilization. Any additions to that? If y'all are brave enough?
I think you still have pockets that are getting just as severe.
Well,
because we tend to want to be ignorant of certain things simply because we refuse to accept.
We live in a world where our media, they're going for clicks, they're going for views, they're going for likes. If there was a situation like this, no matter how far left politically that news media may be, that's going to get attention. I mean, I'm not saying that doesn't happen in certain situations and so on, but at the same time...
Just like they just added brown and black to the gay flag. This thing is
it's
a snowball.
Yeah, well,
churches don't do enough to combat this because it exists within so-called churches.
Well, that's a whole other conversation,
it,
right?
It is, but all I'm saying is we just tend to kind of shy away from it because we don't want to shake it up.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. We can not talk about it all day long, which we're really good at. Because it's uncomfortable. It's awkward. You don't want to talk about this stuff in front of kids, from folks that don't understand what's going on. It just makes people uncomfortable for a good reason. Why does it make you uncomfortable? It's a great question to ask certain people that may feel this totally normal. I think the biggest issue that we're going to face in this next generation, my generation, I think homosexuality was becoming normal, becoming the norm, being cool, was a huge thing. The next thing is going to be gender fluidity. If you don't know what that is, there are some folks that feel that they are male and female, and then there's 15 other definitions in between those two, and then there's pansexual, where it doesn't matter what you are gender-wise, male, female, or anything else, because everybody's all the same. That's confusing, to say the least, to me, but that's going to be an issue that's being pushed more and more and more and more, because now that homosexuality is normal and fine and everything's legal and okay, this whole idea of gender identity is going to be another battle that we're going to have to try to figure out how to deal with. Eric?
I think there's one really key difference here that's going on here for us, anything in BC, and that is, I think it's pretty safe to infer whatever was about to happen here, not completely.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And that's what makes this a whole other level of
awkward. Yeah. So, here's what we find. Verse 5, they say, where are those two guys that are staying in your house? Bring them out that we may know them, right? Very polite way to say exactly what they wanted to do. His solution is not going to be good. Let me just put it that way. And a lot of people have labeled Lot as an absolutely awful, atrocious person because of the so-called solution that he offers. And I am by no means going to try and justify Lot by the decision that he makes instead of turning over these two angels. But it's hard for me to try to imagine this world, much less how I would react in his shoes. So I'm not by any means advocating his so-called solution or his offer or anything, but just removing ourselves from our culture and trying to even somewhat imagine what his life would have been like. This is what he did. Verse 6. So Lot went out to them through the doorway, shut the door behind him, and said, "Please, my brethren." Now we have an idea of where Lot is. He went from someone that separated from Abraham, the father of many nations in the future. He pitched his tent in the direction of Sodom. He got taken captive in that whole political debacle. He's now back home in the city gates, possibly being in a political authority in the city. And now he considers these people his brethren, his friends, his family members in the city. "Please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly. See now," here's his proposition, "I have two daughters who have not yet known a man. Please, let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them as you wish. Only do nothing to these men, since this is the reason they have come under the shadow of my roof." I'm not going to say a whole lot about that. I'm not sure what I can say. Verse 9. And they said, "Stand back." And they said, "This one came in here to stay, and he keeps acting as a judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with him." So they pressed hard against the man Lot and came near to break down the door. But the men reached out their hands and pulled Lot into the house with them and shut the door. So what just happened? He said, "Here is an offer for you." They said, "Nope, we don't know you. You're not from around here." They tried to push through him to get inside the house. These two men, these two angels, pulled him back, shut the door. Verse 11, "And they struck the men who were at the doorway in the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they became weary trying to find the door." What a situation. It's almost like a movie, right? How dramatic it is. They pull Lot in the house, they close the door, angels, boom, everybody's blind. How's that work? No idea. Is it kind of cool to think about, though, that everybody got blinded immediately? A little bit. Verse 12.
"These people were so anxious to do what they wanted to do, they wore themselves out trying to find the door, even though they were struck blind."
Yeah, they were still trying, right? Verse 12. "The men said to Lot, 'Have you anyone else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, whoever else you have in the city, get them out of here. Take them out of this place. Says, look, guys, y'all need to leave. This is not a good environment. No matter what kind of social situation you've got going on here, it's not worth it. You need to get out. For we will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." First time we've heard from the two angels exactly what they were intending to do to Lot himself. Verse 14. "So Lot went out and spoke to his son-in-laws who had married his daughters." He let his daughters marry folks from Sodom. Not saying they were bad people, but
this version says who were to marry his daughters.
Who were to. Future tense. Okay.
Because they had not known a man.
That's true. Well, how many daughters did he have? That's the question, right? So, and he get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But to his son-in-laws, he seemed to be joking. Listen, if you know me at all, you know I am completely saturated in sarcasm. It is really hard for me to say anything sincerely, somewhat emotionally, and not be kidding around, joking, being sarcastic, or whatever. It's a great mask. It's a great way to just not ever reveal your true feelings. It's great. I love it. But this was nothing for Lot to be joking about. And I'm not really sure why they didn't believe him. I don't know. Did he joke around a lot about the place being destroyed? Could be. Did he just say it in such a way that they just didn't believe what he was saying? Whatever the case, his son-in-laws or future son-in-laws were not going to be persuaded. Verse 15. "When the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry." It's like, of course, you've been here all night. We've been trying to get people out of here. Get out of here already. Saying, arise, take your wife, take your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. So how many folks are we talking about here so far? Verse 15. Lot, Lot's wife, two daughters, right? Four people. A little bit less than 10. The bargain for price between Abraham and the Lord, right? Is there a lesson in that? Might be a stretch, but here's one lesson that might be inferred from it. The Lord was not going to destroy the righteous with the wicked anyway. No matter what the number was going to be, he understood the situation. Verse 16, and while he lingered, the men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. Middle of the night, this whole situation happens, says, get your people and get out of here. Next morning, he's still trying to get all his stuff or all his people together. They're going, you need to get out. Third time, they take him by the hands and they drag him out of the city saying, we aren't joking, leave. And so it came to pass when they brought him outside that he said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains lest you be destroyed. And Lot said to them, please, no, my lords. Indeed, now your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have increased your mercy, which you have shown me by the saving of my life. But I cannot escape from the mountains, lest some evil overtake me and I die. What? These angels of God are going to destroy these two cities. They drag you out, kicking and screaming, saying, you need to run for your life. He goes, please. If I go away from where it's going to be killed very soon, I might die. See now, this city is near enough to flee to. And it's a little one. It's just a small little one. Please let me escape there. It's not this little one. And my soul shall live. He said, see, I have favored you concerning this thing, and that I will not overthrow this city for which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there. I can't do anything until you arrive there. Interesting. What does that mean? What orders have they been given? I want to know so bad, but I have no idea what it is. They apparently have very strict orders. They are not to get rid of these cities until Lot and his family are out of there. They're saying, we can't do this until you get out of here. We said, please hurry. It's for our sake to get this over with, not for you. Get out. And therefore, then the city was called Zoar. Let's see how far we have to go. All right, we're going to have to pause here, running for his life, finally negotiating not only for his people, but also for what place they're going to go to. He didn't want to go to the wilderness because he might die. Go figure. This is where we find ourselves. So we'll have to pause here for the morning. We're out of time. Thank you for your attention and your discussion, and we will pick this up with the probably most infamous pillar of salt you've ever read about next time. Thank you very much.